had the fish drive become. He had, in fact, quite forgotten about his once crisp tennis flannels and college blazer, and the fact that the wash of the bilge rising through the floorboards had toe-capped his white plimsolls with a black stain. In Egypt, one seemed to forget oneself continually like this. He blessed the chance letter of introduction which had brought him to the Hosnani lands, to the rambling, old-fashioned house built upon a network of lakes and embankments near Alexandria. Yes. The punt which now carried him, thrust by slow thrust across the turbid water, was turning slowly eastward to take up its position in the great semicircle of boats which was being gradually closed in upon a target area marked out by the black reed spines of fish pans. And as they closed in, stroke by stroke, the Egyptian night fell. The sudden reduction of all objects to bas-reliefs upon a screen of gold and violet. The land had become dense as tapestry in the lilac afterglow, quivering here and there with water mirages from the rising damps, expanding and contracting horizons, until one thought of the world as being mirrored in a soap bubble, trembling on the edge of disappearance. Voices, too, across the water, sounded now loud, now soft and clear. His own cough fled across the lake in sudden wingbeats. Dusk, yet it was still hot. His shirt stuck to his back. The spokes of darkness which reached out to them only outlined the shapes of the reed-fringed islands, which punctuated the water like great pincushions, like paws, like hassocks. Slowly, at the pace of prayer or meditation, the great arc of boats was forming and closing in, but with the land and the water liquefying at this rate, he kept having the illusion that they were travelling across the sky rather than across the alluvial waters of Mariotis. And out of sight, he could hear the splatter of geese, and in one corner, water and sky split apart as a flight rose, trailing its webs across the estuary like seaplanes, honking crassly. Mount Olive sighed and stared down into the brown water, chin on his hands. He was unused to feeling so happy. Youth is the age of despairs. Behind him, he could hear the hare-lipped younger brother Naruz grunting at every thrust of the pole, while the lurch of the boat echoed in his loins. The mud, thick as molasses, dripped back into the water with a slow flob-flob, and the pole sucked lusciously. It was very beautiful, but it all stank so. Yet to his surprise, he found he rather enjoyed the rotting smells of the estuary. Draughts of wind from the far sea line ebbed around them from time to time, refreshing the mind. Choirs of gnats whizzed up there like silver rain in the eye of the dying sun. The cobweb of changing light fired his mind. "Naruz," he said, "I am so happy," as he listened to his own unhurried heartbeats. The youth gave his shy, hissing laugh and said, "Good, good," ducking his head. "But this is nothing. Wait, we are closing in." Mount Olive smiled. "Egypt," he said to himself, as one might repeat the name of a woman. "Egypt." "Over there," said Naruz in his hoarse, melodious voice. "The ducks are not rusé, do you know?" His English was imperfect and stilted. "For the poaching of them it is easy. You say poaching, don't you? You dive under them and take them by the legs. Easier than shooting, eh? If you wish, tomorrow we will go." He grunted again at the pole and sighed. "What about snakes?" said Mount Olive. He had seen several large ones swimming about that afternoon. Naruz squared his stout shoulders and chuckled. "No snakes," he said, and laughed once more. Mount Olive turned sideways to rest his cheek on the wood of the prow. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see his companion standing up as he poled and study the hairy arms and hands, the sturdy, braced legs. "Shall I take a turn?" he asked in Arabic. He had already noticed how much pleasure it gave his hosts when he spoke to them in their native tongue. Their answers...